Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
I'm Tina Horn, and this is Interrobang. Interrobang is the bonus segment of my Wire People Into That podcast. Follow at Tina Horn Sass or at Tina Horn's Ass, if you're nasty, on Twitter and Instagram. Visit wirepeopleintothat.com. Support my show and get extra shit at patreon.com/TinaHorn. That's patreon.com/TinaHorn. Jenny Zhang, I'm so excited that you are here on my couch on my show.
Oh my god, I'm so excited.
So we're going to start out with a little interrobang to get warmed up.
Okay.
Before we talk about fluids.
Yeah.
Let's talk about your work a little bit. So you are a poet and writer and essayist.
Yeah.
And you have a book coming out this year, 2017, called
yeah.
Sour Heart.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about the book?
Yeah, it's a collection of short stories, and they're like all kind of about this group of immigrant families who all kind of know each other. So it's kind of a linked short story collection.
Oh, cool.
Loosely. And they're all narrated by young, basically from prepubescent to adolescent girls.
Awesome.
In the first person. And it's not going to sound cool to describe the plot because there's barely a plot, but I will just say they're kind of they're like close to my heart because they're kind of about just growing up and girlhood and family and bodies and having a body, but also being an immigrant, feeling like an alien in many different ways as it pertains to being a girl, being a woman, being an immigrant, being a person of color, being a Chinese American, and just being a person. So that's all I'll say about it because I can't really make it sound very interesting.
Yeah, it basically sounds like everything else that we've seen in the Western canon for like the history of civilization. So, snore. Just kidding. It sounds amazing.
Thanks.
I can't wait to read it. When does it come out?
It comes out August 2017.
Cool.
Yeah.
Part of the reason that, I mean, I love your writing, and part of the reason that I wanted to have you on the show is that your poetry in particular is just very delightfully, gruesomely obscene and vulgar,
yeah.
And which is kind of up my alley. And I also, I find like so much poetry like so inscrutable, but
yeah.
But like get a little like nastiness in there, and then I'm like, oh. I get it. I
yeah.
like understand. I understand this.
Yeah.
But I wanted to ask you, because I understand like the essay like a lot more than I understand poetry.
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask you like at what point when you know that you want to write about something, do
yeah.
you decide or do you know if it's going to be an essay or a poem?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I feel like with poetry. It can be really fast and loose, and if I feel like I have like a strong sudden urge to say something, I'll often just write it down as, I'm not even thinking of it as a poem, but I'm just writing things down quickly and feeling like I need to, I don't know. It's like when you know you need to sneeze, you just do it. Yes. You can't really like plan for it. And then if I have a thought that feels like it really needs to be planned and plotted in some way, then I guess I'll try to, I don't know. Also, the thing with poetry is because there's no way to make a living off of it.
You don't say.
It just becomes like a receptacle for all the things that you would never try to get paid for. So all the thoughts that you're like, I would never try to pitch this to an editor. I would never try to like find an outlet that could compensate me in any way, because it just feels like a completely uncompensated space and an unmarketable space and an uncommodified space. Obviously, it's still commodified, but it just feels like anything that almost is just like a pure thought that I wouldn't even begin to strategize over how to make any kind of money off of, it becomes a poem.
That is, I don't know if I've ever heard it described that way, but that really helps me to understand it better. Actually, it makes me wonder, like, would you have a different relationship to poetry if we like lived in a parallel universe where poetry was incredibly profitable and being a poet made you a rock star?
Yeah,
on a certain level of commerce.
I wonder, I mean, I don't, has there ever been a civilization where poets were able to, like, I guess, be incorporated into the economy that way? I guess if that were the world, I don't know what would happen to poetry. I think, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I know there are poets who do make a living off of their poetry, and I wonder if those poets have certain tendencies because they can make a living off of their poetry. I don't know.
Yeah.
This is worthy of investigation.
Well, one of that actually dovetails nicely, I am realizing, with one of the things that you were suggesting that we explore or talk about, which is this idea of the horror economy.
Yeah.
Because of course, when hearing you talk about the relationship between like the pure expression of poetry and commerce,
yeah,
in that way, it does make me think of sex work. Most things make me think of sex work, but like it makes me think of the argument that people have that like the exchange of money or the trade of something valuable like shelter,
yeah,
like somehow like taints the human connection of sex, or like makes sex like less moral, less pure, that there's like no possibility of like artful consensual expression of sexuality when commerce is there. And like I know that to be false, but
yeah,
many people, both like feminists and you know, shitbags. The feminists can be shitbags, but like just like complete, like, you know, conservative moral imperialists like make that argument, and it's like a very powerful, strong argument. And so you know,
well, also, but what are people defining or limiting as commerce? Like, that's the question I've never understood, because so many things can be considered a transaction. Like, I never understood the difference between, like, I guess, to take an example of someone who just straight up sells sex explicitly for money versus, I mean, why is it, isn't it a transaction when you get married? Isn't it a transaction?
I mean,
aren't all of those things in exchange for some kind of material comfort, safety, promise? It doesn't seem like there's that fine a distinction, right?
I mean, you're preaching to the converted. I completely agree with you. But so, like, I mean, I think that we're like starting to like wade into the morass of like what is that hypocrisy about? Like, you know, I mean, it's obviously about social control, because marriage is, you know, a very important institution that we need to protect at all costs.
Yeah.
You know, but it is, I mean, it's a institution that's regulated by the state.
Right.
You know, and in most countries in 2017, prostitution is not regulated by the state.
Right.
It's criminalized. I mean, it is regulated by the state, actually.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's such a big...
I know, it's so huge.
Yeah.
Of a topic.
But what... Why... What do you mean when you say the whore economy?
I guess I just mean truly like the way in which, I guess young girls or anyone who grew up feeling or being either feeling femme or being socialized to feel femme or the way that people like that become so aware of. Just the whore economy is like the way in which every single second you are aware of your value.
Yeah.
And you are aware of whether it's going down, it's going up. You're always aware if you're common or if you're rare.
Mm.
And like, I mean, it's interesting because rarity is considered a good thing. And by rarity, I mean like, someone, for example, who has huge tits that don't sag naturally. Like, right. This would be considered an amazing commodity to have.
Totally.
And you will never be able to get through this world without knowing that. Like, should you have that by totally. Some whatever fluke of genetics. And then
like, you can't, well, your ability to enjoy your body, yeah. to, like, love your tits, to
right.
feel proud of your tits, to, like, look in the mirror and be like... this coincidence of genetics and nature that has given me this is fucking awesome and I love right. this about myself, or to like accept someone else's appreciation totally. Of that is like always going to be undermined or compromised or in some cases like just completely like destroyed by totally. the inability to like separate it from like the external like yeah. judgment of value.
Totally. And should you have any other, I don't know, ideas about how your life would like to go and ways to achieve, you know, your dreams, you can't neglect, I don't know, just the impact of your body. And and like, if you do have, for example, like a body that's considered extremely conventionally attractive, you're also like set up poorly by the whore economy, because you're not set up to have any longevity. Like, at some point your body will no longer be that perfect, quote unquote, body. And unless you realize that extremely young, and why would you? Like, how could you know that when you're 15 years old?
Right.
That this will not be able to sustain you for the rest of your life.
Right.
And that you will have to make adjustments, or you'll have to be dependent on the very people who create this economy and will discard you within that economy once you no longer have value, quote unquote. I don't know. That's
but you're also set up. You're also set up for failure, because you're not like, let's say you are 15 and you're like, I'm banging, and I know that everybody yeah. is gonna think so for at least, you know, for the next
two 10 decades,
year, yeah, mid yeah. 10, 20 years. So, like, I'm gonna like learn a lot of business skills and like right. figure out how to like live. For literally capitalize off of this right. and like create like a sustainable life right. for myself because of this asset that I have, in the same way that somebody at 15 who is, I don't know, like a math whiz
right.
could be like, okay, I'm gonna start getting set up now to
exactly
I don't know, make my fortune off of math. Do people do that? I don't know.
Yeah, no, totally. Yeah, I guess I just think about, it's just interesting that, I mean, it's not even interesting, I don't know what it is, it just is, like, we're just constantly making calculations based on this. And I think it's also true that, like, whether or not you're like explicitly trading in this economy, you're just constantly aware. Like, if you want to, like, I don't know, like, let's say you want to be like an artist who gets like your work shown in a gallery, you're not going to act on that independent of how your attractiveness and fuckability is going to be perceived. It'll always just be a factor for any femme person or any person who might be considered feminine and or outside of the I'm not saying like it's only true for people who identify as femme, but I just mean that is the way that I don't know, society judges women and
a lot of this stuff does orbit around femininity,
yeah,
and not necessarily in relation to gender. I mean, then if you think about like the relative like devaluing of like for example, a cis man who like has feminine qualities.
Right.
Like that, I don't know. I mean, maybe people are like so threatened by the idea of the faggot because it undermines this the status quo of of being able to like control femininity through like applying value to it. I mean,
totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. Totally agree.
So what? So are you gonna write a poem or an essay about it?
I don't
know. Or a collection of short stories?
If I were someone who actually had, like, I don't know, a sustained interest in developing intellectual ideas, I guess I would write some kind of essay about, I don't know, the ideology of the horror economy. But I don't, it's just sort of like a thought that's always in the back of my head. Mm. And I mean, I think about it because I think about, for example, like the ways in which my poems are received.
Mm.
As they, like, if I looked differently, if I didn't have the body I had, if I had a body that was like less acceptable,
yeah,
because it didn't look sort of hetero, cis, and feminine, and I was saying stuff about like flinging blood clots out of my pussy, like, I would be received very differently.
True.
I would be possibly received with way more vitriol and hatred and disgust. And I'm like aware that I'm lucky that I can quote unquote temper these poems by having an acceptable body. And it just is like a thing I think about often, and I'm aware of that, or I'm aware that if some panel wants to seem edgy, but not like too out there, they can bring me on because I seem, despite having done nothing to earn respectability, I just seem respectable because of how I look.
No, I mean, so yeah, like your work is all it. I mean, your poems that I've read are like very abject and like committed to exploring things that are considered disgusting, and which I also love exploring, but that's really interesting that for so many people that there is like a tension or a contrast between like your relative like lack of disgustingness to them. But is that what is your experience with that? Like, or can you describe like a specific experience where you felt very aware of your relationship to the horror economy or the relationship to the value of your femininity vis-a-vis your poems?
I think just, I mean, I think one, it's unfair because there are other people who are, it's hard to even talk about because when we talk about like discrepancies in diversity in the grandest sense of the word, we're talking about people who were discouraged so early on that we don't even get to see what work they could have been producing.
Totally.
And so I'm not even just talking about people who are writing like great shit about their bodies and about sex that's transgressive and interesting, but I'm like thinking of people who didn't even get that encouragement when they were much, much younger and just didn't even
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well,
HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
I to go there.
This ship is lonely.
July is BOGO month for vibrators at the Pleasure Chest. Yes, that's right. For the entire month of July, anything that vibrates at the Pleasure Chest is buy one, get one, half off. That goes for the New York City, Chicago, and Los Angeles stores, or from anywhere in the world on PleasureChest.com. If you want to learn more about vibrators, don't miss my interview with Victor Tobar on your Wire People Into That feed. Victor explains the difference between external vibes, G-spot vibes, vibrating butt plugs, dual stem rabbits, and much, much more. And don't miss out on free sex ed workshops all month long at Pleasure Chest stores. On July 26th at 8 p.m. local times, all three cities are doing OMG spot classes. So that's on the Upper East Side of New York with Sloan, at the Lincoln location in Chicago with Tanya and Chloe, and in West Hollywood, Los Angeles with Coco and Carly. Visit PleasureChest.com and follow Pleasure Chest on Twitter and Instagram so you never miss a workshop or sweet deal on your new favorite sex toys. Oh, and don't forget to let the Pleasure Chest know that you heard about the workshop on Why Are People Into That. I love Showgirls, but it's not exactly like a paragon of good behavior. But I mean, that's part of the joy of it. But it's also like made by
that's
a bunch
with
of
Elizabeth Berkley.
Yeah, you must see this film. It's speaking of.
I think I've seen that sex scene.
Yeah, the dolphin sex scene. Yeah. It's the whole thing is just like.
Did you call it a dolphin?
That's what people call it because really? she kind of makes these like weird dolphin noises as she's like thrashing around.
And the
around.
Way that her body is moving is I've never seen an upper body move that way while getting fucked. Like,
I don't think anyone else had ever seen that before either.
It was shocking to me when I was 12 or whatever, because I was like, what the hell, I can never do this, like,
yeah,
my body will never be able
I'm
to.
Never gonna have sex.
Like, I can't flip like that.
Oh my god.
So funny.
Yeah, no, the pitch of camp in that movie is like such, it's like listening to like a show with like a lot of feedback.
Yeah,
you know, it's just like, but I love it. But it's not for everyone. But.
Yeah. Well, I was just going to say, like, for me, and maybe the most common one, and this is often before people, like, this is when someone is experiencing my work or encountering it for the first time, they'll often say things like, they'll be like, you know, your work is very sexual. Did you know that? And it's like, no shit. Yeah, I wrote it. I'm aware of myself.
Are you aware that somebody else snuck into your poems and put sex in?
Or they'll be like, you just seem like a doll and you seem so innocent.
Oh,
but
Jesus.
Then you like read these poems. And then I realize like, oh, they're just reacting in the most like base way to a very shallow and superficial like impression of how I look. And that happens like in every direction too. That happens in the direction of people kind of like not expecting me, for example, to like identify as an immigrant because I look, I guess, like assimilated or something. I don't look like someone who immigrated to the United States, but that is what I am, and anyone can look like an immigrant. I mean, I guess this is kind of stuff that people are more aware of now, unfortunately, but it's just this way of being like, well, you know, I mean, so this is why I don't even know what I'm talking about when I say the horror economy, because on the one hand, it's like there's a certain type of value ascribed to someone who looks educated, who looks, whose body conforms within certain, you know, criteria of desirability. But then there's also a kind of like lasciviousness that's given to bodies that are considered like aberrant. Is how you say that word?
Aberrant. Yeah.
Aberrant.
Yeah.
See, this is my immigrant self coming through. I never learned certain English words. I used to say ternal for until I was 18 years old because I'd only ever heard non-native English speakers say the word tunnel.
Ugh.
And I hadn't been in a car with like a native born like English speaker driving underneath a tunnel. So I just said ternal for like the first 18 years of my life. Aberrant. Okay. Yeah.
So. I think you're doing fine.
But you know, there's also like the ways in which like certain bodies that are not considered like beautiful, thin and white are assigned like a sexuality. And it's just, there's just so many different, and then there's ways in which like the East Asian body is often like used to chastise like a black body or like a brown body. So there's just ways in which I know I'm being used to cause harm, even though all I'm doing is existing as a person. But it, I mean, that's the horror, I guess, of this horror economy.
Yeah, well, I mean, because part of this paradox that you're getting at is that, you know, your body, or the type of body that you're talking about, is valued and also seen as available for consumption and incapable of subjectivity, or allowed only a controlled allowance of subjectivity, or contextualized subjectivity. So and then like my question with that is, what does it mean to be aware of the perception that your body is available for consumption and to use that for your own benefit? You know, because some people would argue that when you do that, you're trying to dismantle the master's house with the master's tools, right? And you're feeding into or perpetuating systems of oppression, and like so that the only way to like end patriarchal systems of oppression is to like shatter them. But like in the meantime, we're like out here trying to live,
right
so right. I don't know if I mean I have feelings about that with regards to sex work, but I wonder if that also applies to poetry. Like I wonder how you feel about like understanding those assumptions about you and like using them in your work for your own benefit.
Well, it's interesting because it is true. I mean, much like sex work. I mean, all bodies age and change. And at some point, I won't be a young, cute, by patriarchal standards, female.
Right.
And, you know, should I live on into this world? At some point, my relationship to my body will change, and how my body is traded and commodified and used will change. And if I continue to write about like my pussy into my 80s, it'll be regarded and received just much differently than if I do that in my 20s. And and that's the, you know, that's because, especially if I haven't, destroyed the master's house, and I'm still, I at that point,
can you
like
get on that thing, please?
But so I think it's just, I've always been aware of that. Like even at, I don't know why, but I knew from the very first time someone complimented me or treated me nicer because of how I looked, I knew from the moment that pleasure hit that it would harm me if I couldn't let go of the temporary pleasure or dopamine hit from someone being like, I like you because of how you look. So I don't know what that means, if that is helpful, but I just know that I have to have a core that is not connected to that. I have to develop a meaningful core that I can return to as my body changes and as my femininity changes and as like my womanhood changes. And I think that people who, I mean, not to presume, but I do think that people who are engaged in sex work or any kind of work that requires constant attention to their body.
Yeah.
I think that's also a thing that they have to do to survive as they get older and age. Because otherwise, if you are only connected to your body, I don't know, just at some point it's just diminishing returns is all I can say.
So, yeah, well, I want to return to and like talk about this idea of a meaningful core and how do we develop the meaningful core. But you also said that you wanted to talk about sex and aging, and you just were talking about your aging cobweb filled pussy, you know, presumably. So I'm wondering what's on your mind when you suggested sex and age.
I don't know. I didn't have a very, I didn't think about it very deeply, to be honest, but I think I'm just, maybe it's, you know, I'm in my 30s now, and, I thought that this would be, I don't know. At some point in my life, I was like, I guess that'll be the end for me.
Oh my God, me too. I don't know if that's I'm also in my early 30s, and I like, maybe it's like our generation. I don't know.
Yeah.
That I like definitely, I mean, it's not like, you know, 30 years ago was, or like, I guess it's more like 40, almost 50 years ago, there was, of course, the like, I hope I die before I get old attitude, right? Of boomers. But like, I'm not like aware of like where that, I mean, people are living longer.
Right.
Adolescence is going longer. So like, why did we,
yeah.
A lot of people I know have had this attitude where it's like, that's, well, it's going to be over when we're 30, you know. Also there's like less pressure to like be breeding by 23,
right.
Or like, right. Have like own a home or have,
right.
A, you know, all,
right.
All that shit. Like, so why do we still think that this is going to be it for us?
I don't know. It's really disturbing.
It is disturbing.
It's a very young age. I don't know. I mean, once I turned 30, I was so happy. Did you feel really,
yeah.
Happy to be in your
30s? Oh, yeah. Being in my 30s is great.
It's the best decade I've ever had so far,
yeah.
Of all three. but I think, I don't know. I think also because of, like, the way often that, like, East Asian women are perceived, just a lot of people would say things, a lot of men would have said to me like, oh, don't worry, like, you're gonna look 20 well into your 30s. And that was like a refrain where they're like, don't worry, as if to say, God, everyone else in their 30s, dinosaurs dead.
you'll look, okay. Like a, yeah. Doll.
But then it just makes you more aware of like, oh, so then when's the like that there is a cutoff, even,
right?
That life ends, it drops off at some point, like you are just of no value as your gender after a certain cutoff point. And so I kind of had this in my mind when I was much younger, you know, like a teenager. I was like, oh, like, I don't know, it's just gonna be so bad in my 30s.
So but how's it been?
It's been really great. And I mean, the thing that, I mean,
how's the sex been is what I really want to know.
That's the thing, right? Because also when you're, at least when I was in my 20s, I couldn't drop the awareness of wanting to be, I wanted to be liked more than I wanted to come. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
And in your 30s, I want to sleep more than I want to do anything and get good rest.
Oh, yeah.
And then second to that, I want to enjoy sex when I choose to have it.
Fuck,
but
yeah.
Before, I just wanted to look good.
Yeah.
And so it's liberating to get older because I don't know. It's almost like, well, I'm not going to be considered a hot young thing anyway, so I'm not going to worry about that. It's sad that that had to happen, that I had to realize that first, but that is what happened, to be totally honest, where I was like, well, the time for me to be impressive, gorgeous, and 18 is over. it just is. And I'm glad it is, because now I don't have to ever worry about that again. And all the years I ever spent worrying about that were wastes. It was a waste of a worry, and it gave me nothing, did nothing for me. It just made me vulnerable to predators, if anything. And now I can just, I don't know, it's just, I can just enjoy myself. So aging has felt really good in that sense.
Cool.
And in some weird way, I think it's because, again, it's because, like, I'm not, like, there are many narratives of me in some ways, in mainstream depictions of sex, because I'm just because I basically look like a small cishet femme or whatever. So I think because I don't feel very excluded and boxed out of depictions of sex, because there's just plenty of depictions of heterosexual sex between cis women and cis men, because I never felt that excluded, but at the same time I am excluded because patriarchy is so intense that only a very specific type of cishet woman gets depicted.
Totally.
And it, you know, it just comes down to whiteness. It comes down to thinness. It comes down to being under the age of 28 or something like that. If we're talking about Hollywood, or 23 or something, like, you know, so then there are ways in which I'm also excluded, but it almost feels good to be excluded, because then it's like, oh, well, that world of mainstream depictions of sex is just irrelevant to me and my sex life. It does not need to bear upon anything I do. It's just so irrelevant. It's just looking at a piece of technology that will no longer work in any outlet, in any wall. Like, it's just
so pointless. Oh my god, it's so obsolete. Oh my god, it's like a weird, like, USB.
Yes. Just like, exactly. It's those floppy disks that you can't insert into anything.
Oh my god, heterosexuality is totally a floppy disk. I do not have a drive for that.
You can't view it. It's just, it has no value. So in that sense, like, aging has been great too, because I'm like, okay, I none of that matters.
Yeah. Do you think it's going to keep getting better?
I hope so. I mean, I don't know. I don't know. I mean, 30s is good because it's before too many physical bodily problems have hit, or financial, familial issues.
Yeah.
So it's kind of the freest age, don't you think? In some ways, depending on where you're at in your life, I guess. I don't have kids, so, and I don't have any, I guess, knock on wood, major health problems right now.
Yeah.
So it feels free for me.
Yeah, I also know a lot of very virile people in their 40s. I'm looking, getting to 30 and feeling so good in it is like, has been freeing in the sense that I'm like, oh, I won't get fooled again about, like, other decades, right? So now all of a sudden I'm like looking at 40 and I'm like, damn,
can't wait.
I'm going to be a silver fox. I'm going to get really obsessed with, like, rowing or something like that, and get up really early.
Yes.
And do stuff.
Yes.
Yeah, I can't wait.
Also, it feels like the older you get, the more, at least for me, emboldened I am to say no. And that feels amazing.
Yes. Yeah, I'm more and more like, I didn't come here to make friends.
Yeah.
On this planet. I mean, I did come here to make friends, but I've, like, kind of made them already.
Totally.
And now I'm like, yeah, yeah.
Right.
And what you were saying about, like, casting about in your younger sex life, it took me until the age of, like, 33 or so to, like, really be honest with myself about the fact that my sex life in my 20s was, I definitely treated it like a game in which the objective was to, like, secure attention.
Yeah.
And, like, and that and that I would like win and get right. the like elation of totally. Success when someone like admitted that they wanted to sleep with me yes. And slept with me. And it was less like that I was looking for like an experience. I mean, part of that was feeling like very like having, I guess like a meaningful core, like yeah. of like self-love and like the ability to like enjoy like freely enjoy sexual pleasure, like totally. In solo sex and like having a lot of like intimate and very like physically open totally. Relationships with a lot of friends. But yeah, in terms of like getting laid,
yeah,
I was not like, oh, I'm so glad I had such a good orgasm from that. I would be like, yeah. oh, I'm so glad that that person that I like nailed that, you know, I don't know. Anyway.
Totally. And when you're talking, it made me think too, that one of my goals when I was younger and having sex was to be like a wonderful mystery to the person I was fucking. And I was like, it was just like, yes, I'm a mystery to them. Yeah. Like I've succeeded. And then, and that's so unsustainable also yeah. because then I would get really scared when that person got to know me, because right. I would be like, well, it's over now. How yeah. will I ever be attractive to this person again?
I actually had the opposite experience of not, of never understanding like the dynamic of playing hard to get, and like yeah. never, I just like don't have like a mysterious bone in my body. So I have to just like spill my guts all the time. Ooh. Which I get, we don't talk about spilling our guts when we talk about fluids, but yeah. like I that is just like my like constant drive to be like, let's like get everything on the table. And so, and my
would
frustration.
Would you be attracted to people who weren't like that?
Sometimes people who were like, there are people who like, I even like continue to find attractive because they are like cool and aloof and withholding yeah. a yeah. little bit, but like mostly my drive is for, yeah, people who are like, let's just like make a big pile of guts and yeah. like play in them. But I found it incredibly frustrating and like impossible to understand that people would like lose interest in me because I was not building a mystery.
Yeah.
As Sarah McLachlan would have said at the time. man, the stuff that stays in your head.
I know, right?
So yeah, so but even hearing you say that you were like plotting mystery
yeah.
is like healing to me, because yeah. also no one would, you would destroy the mystery if you admitted that totally. You were trying to make a mystery, and probably people are like building a mystery when they're like not even aware that that is what they're
right
doing.
Totally. And it's just also like fear of intimacy and
right.
and thinking that intimacy is antithetical to hot sex, for example,
right,
when it couldn't be. I mean, many things can prevent you from having hot sex, and intimacy can sometimes be, but it's not, you know, by nature, the opposite of, yeah. And oftentimes, I mean, this is something I'm learning in my 30s, is being intimate with someone makes you more attracted to them and feel yeah. closer and have better sex often. And yeah. that was something I never understood in my 20s, mm. Just, I think because there are very few depictions, for all that we're like interested in seeing depictions of sex, there's very, very few good depictions of sex and intimacy.
Well, it doesn't make for very good story.
I guess not.
I mean, think about like your friends, like if you're hanging out with your friends that are like really in love and they right. are like speaking their like cute little codes to each other
right.
and just like staring deep into each other's eyes and like smiling and being that. Happy yeah. and you're like this is so tedious, get me yeah. the fuck out of here. And like even like I don't want to subject someone to like me being
totally.
Like, you know, but like you know, and I'm like much better able now to like embrace, to like not totally. Feel embarrassed by that, like when I'm just alone with that person.
Yeah.
Like be like, oh yeah, like happiness and intimacy yeah. or like being boring yeah. is great. But going back to it being boring, like that just doesn't make, that's not it's good. True. That's not good TV, you know?
I just wish that there was some kind of sex education. I mean, obviously there's a lot of changes that need to be made to sex education to make it actually comprehensive and useful. But I wish that there was some education to not just about physical sex, but like how do you get close to someone and what's actual closeness, what, you know, what is the closeness that I don't know, like a narcissist for example might bring and look like intense closeness but actually isn't, or what's a kind of closeness that's abusive, what's a kind of closeness that's consensual. Like those are things that I was learning, the physical, sexual aspects of that before I learned like the emotional aspects of that. And it still fucked with me that I didn't understand like emotional consent, or I just had no one, I think, because maybe a lot of people have this, but the only example I had were my parents, and because they grew up in a very different culture than me, I just dismissed their example. And even though they actually have a very good example of intimacy and I could have learned a lot from them, but to me I was like, well, I live in America and nobody in America falls in love this way, so I'm gonna disregard this example of closeness and respect. And I was at sea. I had no idea what I was supposed to be looking for. I don't know, did you have ideas of that when you were in your like early relationships with people?
I was too driven to look for this, for like the qualities of friendship in my early relationships, because I thought that that would be safer.
Oh, interesting.
And so I like most of my early relationships were with like people who I like confused my attraction to someone's like best friend qualities with sexual attraction, and was like very, you know, like largely like sexually unsatisfied, but like very, but did feel like I was, you know, I did feel safe. I was safe.
Yeah.
And you know, like very intimate and like had a lot of fun and like some like good fun sexy times, but like then in my late 20s I like went through I just like went on a rampage, but I also like I sort of had to like swing the pendulum in the other direction and like sort of be like, what is this whole like emotional volatility thing about? like oh, the sex is really hot, like but then like get through that and learn from that, and then now I feel like I've experienced sort of that duality, and that like has helped me to find happiness.
Yay.
And practice discernment. So but going back to what you were saying about parents, it's really not fair to, I mean, parents do a lot.
Yeah.
You know, they're like keeping you alive. It's like a lot to expect them to also be a like model of what intimacy can be, because also like the intimacy that worked for your parents might not be the right intimacy for you, maybe because you're the child of immigrants, or you are immigrants yourself, you know, you're an immigrant and you're like living in a different culture than your parents grew up in, maybe just because, you know, they're like necessarily they're always going to be a different generation. The world is different. Or you might be queer, or you might be like any number of things. I think that made it easy for me to like not model myself after my parents, and just like, oh well, the relationships that I want are not going to be like this.
Right
So that's like a gift of the genius of being queer.
Yeah. It's that thing where it's like, well, I don't see my story reflected at all in their stories, so it's irrelevant to my desires. It's I'm just not going to go for that. It's a different model.
But then you also kind of have to like dig into the, you know, inevitable psychological.
I know.
You know.
It's true. I know. You can't get away from the psychological stew you were like raised in.
Oh my god, so true. Listen, I could talk about psychological stew all day, but I totally want to switch gears and do and talk about fluids if that is cool with you.
Won't fill the holes of my mind. The things I'm dreaming of.
Interrobang is produced and hosted by yours truly, Tina Horn. Our theme music is by my brother from another mother, Moot. Thanks for listening.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.